This episode examines a case involving a minor under the age of 10. Some details may be disturbing and upsetting. Listener discretion is advised. Christian Ferguson was born with a life-threatening illness. While he had the ability to live as close to a normal life as possible, it did require a strict regimen of medications and dietary restrictions. His parents underwent detailed training on how to properly take care of their son. After a difficult divorce and multiple battles in court, Christian's father, Dewan, was granted custody of his two sons. Christian's mother, Theta, would contest this ruling multiple times and make accusations of neglect and abuse against her ex-husband, though these accusations could never be proven. When Christian was 7 years old, his illness came on strong, and the child slipped into a coma and sustained severe brain damage. From that day on, he had to relearn how to walk, couldn't speak or swallow, and a feeding tube had to be implanted. On the morning of June 11th, 2003, Dewan made a call to 911 to report that his vehicle had been stolen and that his disabled 9-year-old son Christian was in the back seat. 2 hours later, the vehicle was recovered, though Christian was never found. Almost immediately, investigators were suspicious, and this kicked off an investigation that would reveal horrifying details and disturbing truths. Despite uncovering a great deal of information, there was never enough evidence for charges to be filed. Some 16 years later, Christian remains listed as an endangered missing child, though the police who worked the case, and Christian's own mother, believe he may have been deceased before that 911 call was even made. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 75, The Disappearance of Christian Ferguson. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine the bizarre disappearance of 9-year-old Christian Ferguson. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances, examining a different case each Monday. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter at @TraceEvPod, on Instagram at @TraceEvidencePod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence. You can visit the website at trace-evidence.com for full episodes, social media links, merchandise, and much more. Trace Evidence is also on Patreon, so if you would like to support the show, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence, where you can get rewards such as stickers, pins, and commercial-free episodes. There's also a PayPal donation link on the website for those of you who don't wish to go through Patreon. This show is a complete one-man operation, and your support is greatly appreciated. Today we discuss the disappearance of Christian Ferguson, a case I've been looking at for nearly 2 years, and the one which I have found the most difficult to write about. This is Episode 75, The Disappearance of Christian Ferguson. Christian Taylor Ferguson was born on October 9, 1993 in St. Louis, Missouri, to parents Dewan and Theta. St. Louis is located along the western bank of the Mississippi River and boasts a population of just over 300,000 residents, though the city itself is considered the center of the St. Louis metropolitan area, which has more than 3 million residents. The city itself is easily recognizable by the famous Gateway Arch commemorating the city as the gateway to the West. At the moment of birth, Christian appeared to be a healthy, happy baby boy who fit snugly into the crook of his mother's arm. However, things would take a life-threatening turn just 2 days later. While the day began positively with Theta being set for discharge to bring her son home, Christian suddenly became extremely ill. At 5 a.m., the infant was taken by medevac to the Cardinal Glennon Children's Medical Center. Initially, doctors were baffled by what could have happened to transform Christian from a seemingly healthy child to having his life hanging on by a thread. Of this frightening and uncertain time, Theda later said, quote, "He was so sick, they thought that he would die, but at first, they couldn't explain it," end quote. Christian fell into a coma shortly after his arrival at the Children's Medical Center, and for the next 24 hours, doctors performed a battery of tests in an attempt to determine what was causing the dramatic drop in health. When medical staff finally found the answer to the frightening riddle, it was just as concerning as the initial question had been. Christian had been born with an autosomal recessive urea cycle disorder known as citrullinemia. The urea cycle are a series of chemical reactions taking place in the liver that process excess nitrogen generated when protein is broken down by the body. Citrullinemia disrupts this urea cycle, inhibiting the breakdown of nitrogen in the form of ammonia, which then begins building up in the bloodstream along with other toxic substances. As ammonia builds up, the patient will lose energy, vomit, experience seizures, and even loss of consciousness. In some cases, a patient may develop lifelong liver problems as a result of this, and if the disorder isn't diagnosed quickly enough, it can certainly be lethal. There are two forms of citrullinemia, type 1 and type 2, with type 1 appearing within the first few days of life, while type 2 typically doesn't show up until adulthood. Citrullinemia is the result of a gene mutation and is a hereditary disorder affecting 1 in 57,000 children. While the disorder is dangerous regardless, there are varying degrees of severity. Christian's particular diagnosis was considered more towards the extreme side. Christian awoke from his coma after 3 days, and while the diagnosis was devastating and frightening to the family, there are treatment options which can in some cases result in the child developing normally, and while having to be on a strict medicinal and dietary regimen, proceed on to develop as any other child would. Christian's parents underwent an intensive routine of training in order to be able to both administer 6 different medications multiple times a day while also being conscious of the child's behavior, including looking out for warning signs such as confusion, balance issues, and vomiting. For Theda, she was determined to make it work and even developed her own system to make the administration of the medication easier on Christian. Theda later explained, quote, "I had to hold him a special way to get the syringe in his mouth so he'd take the medicine. I'd give him a little grenadine and sugar to kill the taste. And eventually it got to the point where he took it all by himself in a cup," end quote. When Christian was well enough, Theda and Dewan took him home, renting an apartment in South St. Louis. It was around this time that Theda began pushing for marriage as the young couple were unwed. They had met years earlier, when both were attending high school in the 1980s. At the time when Theda became pregnant, she was a 20-year-old college student and Dewan was 19 and moving from job to job. Theda was in love with Dewan and dreamed of marrying him and raising a family together. This was partially due to her feelings for Dewan and perhaps in part due to her upbringing. Having been raised in a Catholic family with 3 siblings, it was important to Theda. She'd already felt incredibly guilty for having a child out of wedlock and worried that her choice to have intimate relations before marriage may have resulted in God punishing her by making Christian sick. According to Theda, Dewan seemed evasive over the topic of marriage, although he would eventually acquiesce. Dewan's mother later contradicted this, explaining that her son had wanted to marry Theda and she couldn't talk him out of it. Regardless, the young couple married 4 months after Christian's birth on Valentine's Day, 1994. Less than a year later, a second child, Connor, would come along. Everything seemed to be going well, and Christian was developing. It was always a risk, of course. At any moment, his disorder could turn lethal. But for the time being, his growth proceeded without incident. By the time Christian was 3 years old, the situation between his parents had been corroding. They had moved from their South St. Louis apartment to a house owned by Dewan's grandmother in the northern part of the city. Dewan at this time had taken to working different jobs at his stepfather's construction company. Theda had continued on with her schooling, and while there was obviously love there, the couple simply couldn't keep things together. Their disagreements were becoming more intense and even began venturing into mutual displays of physical violence. Theta later stated, quote, "We were fighting all the time. Finally, you know, it was his house. And he said, 'You're mad about this? You're mad about that? You can get out.'" End quote. Unfortunately, this was only the beginning of the battle between these two. Theta moved out of the home, taking both of the boys with her, and she went to live with her parents. Dewan filed for divorce fairly quickly, though in his divorce filing, he was seeking full custody of both Christian and Connor, and he wanted Theta to pay child support. Theta responded by filing a lawsuit saying that the marriage should be annulled and that she should be granted full custody of the children. Ultimately, a technicality related to the issuance of their marriage license led a judge to go through with the annulment in 1998, and at that time, Theta was granted full custody while Dewan was given visitation, though this would certainly not be the end of their legal encounters. Just over a month later, the two would be back before a judge. It was a bitter dispute, with Dewan arguing that Theta hadn't been following the visitation agreement, wouldn't give him Christian's medicines, and that she had falsely accused him of child abuse to the Missouri Department of Social Services. Theta argued that Dewan had been driving with the children in his car, despite there being warrants out for him in regard to traffic violations. She went further, alleging that every time Dewan came into custody of the boys, Christian wasn't being taken care of properly and would get ill within a day. After a vicious and hateful set of exchanges, the judge ultimately sided with Dewan, awarding him custody until a new trial could take place. A major factor in this decision was the opinion of a court-appointed guardian ad litem who sided with Dewan. According to the Guardian, Theta had been interfering in Dewan's relationship with the boys. Theta would argue she did all that she could to look out for the health and safety of her children, and she would demonstrate this by conducting protests outside of the courthouse, made up of friends and family members. Other factors in the court proceedings included that, at the time, Theta was making minimum wage, while Dewan was making far beyond that, working for his stepfather. In addition to that, his stepfather had gotten him a high-priced lawyer and was paying the tab. In 1999, the final judgment came down, issued by Judge Thomas Frawley. Dewan would be granted full custody, and Theta would be ordered to pay a monthly child support amount of $229. Theta was devastated, as she was only granted visitation, consisting of 6 hours on 3 Saturdays per month. The arrangement remained in place, and despite the legal wrangling back and forth, Christian was doing well. He was even beginning to attend school, and his illness seemed to be in check, but everything would soon change. In January of 2001, Christian would be rushed to the hospital by his father when he was discovered unconscious in bed with sheets soaked in vomit. Upon arrival at the hospital, Christian suffered what was described as a major seizure, lasting more than 3 minutes, and then sunk into a coma. While Christian was clinging to life, Dewan and Theta began screaming at one another in the hospital, and the interaction quickly turned violent. This encounter would result in both mother and father trying to get the other removed from being able to visit Christian in the hospital, with accusations of threats, verbal assaults, and that the other's behavior was negatively impacting their son. After a letter from hospital social workers and complaints on both sides, a judge split each day into 2 12-hour halves and designated which parent was allowed to visit during which half. It was decreed that both parents were not to be in the hospital simultaneously. Theta's visits were to be supervised by hospital staff, though she didn't take this ruling silently. She fired back by contacting social services and accusing Dewan of neglect, feeling that he did not respond to Christian's illness quickly enough. Christian's doctor, however, supported Dewan, arguing that he had responded as best and as quickly as he could be expected to, given the circumstances. However, there were at least 2 instances in the prior 2 years during which Christian had been taken to the emergency room, and it was found that Dewan had not given him his medication. Theta wasn't done yet. She began protesting outside of the hospital, as she had done with the court, and also contacted the St. Louis Police Department's Child Abuse and Sex Crimes Unit, wanting Dewan investigated, and while the agency took the report, they determined there was not enough there to require a full investigation. Christian awoke from his coma in February, having been in the coma for nearly a month. Unfortunately, It was quickly discovered that the child had sustained brain damage, and from that day forward, he would never be the same. He had lost the ability to speak, had to wear a diaper, and was no longer able to swallow, and had to undergo surgery to fit him with a feeding tube. His ability to walk had been lost, though he would go through months of physical therapy to regain that ability. After 6 months in the hospital, Christian was discharged back into his father's care in June of 2001. The next year, relations between Dewan and Theta began to warm up. It was during this time that Dewan allowed his ex to visit the boys a little more frequently, even letting Theta look after the boys some days if he was overwhelmed, tired, or had an appointment. In the beginning of 2003, Christian's case came under review by the Department of Health and Services. They canceled Dewan's nursing benefits in March of that year. These benefits had seen nurses coming to the home to help take care of Christian. This cancellation was allegedly due to the fact that Christian had not been enrolled in school as DHS had specified to his father. Later that month, when Theta and the boys went for a weekend, she saw signs which she believed indicated neglect. Christian, as well, seemed to be bumping into objects and she could smell ammonia, and so she rushed him to the hospital. While Christian was admitted, Theta's visitation time expired. Things seemed to decline between the two again, with Dewan failing to bring the boys for Theta's next two visits. By April, Theta was in court again, trying to regain custody of the boys. In June, both parents stood before Judge Frawley once again. This time, Dewan was ordered to allow Theta her court-ordered visitation, or he would be held in contempt of court. Visitation, according to the court, was set to resume on June 14, 2003, but Theta would never get the opportunity to see Christian again, because by the time June 14th came along, Christian would have been missing for 3 days. On the morning of Wednesday, June 11th, Dewan stated he was taking now 9-year-old Christian to the hospital after discovering that the child had been vomiting throughout the night. According to Dewan, he grabbed Christian, who at the time was only wearing a diaper, wrapped him up in a blanket, and placed him in the back seat of his maroon 1998 Ford Expedition SUV and began the drive. Shortly after 6 a.m., the St. Louis Police Department received a 911 call from Dewan. According to him, his SUV had been stolen and Christian was still in the back seat when the thief had driven off. When officers arrived on the scene, Dewan explained that Christian's life would be at risk due to his illness if there was no one there to treat him. When asked how the SUV was stolen, Dewan told investigators that he had stopped to call the hospital. Parking his SUV and leaving it running with the keys in the ignition, he walked approximately 100 yards to a small strip of stores on Page Boulevard near the border of St. Louis and Wellston to use the payphone, and it was during this time that the vehicle was taken. According to Dewan, the vehicle had taken off heading east, but he had not actually seen who had taken it and could supply investigators with no description. According to the police report, Dewan stated that Christian had been wrapped in a blue and red blanket and that he would be difficult to notice in the back seat if he didn't wake up and move around. A massive search was launched with an all-points bulletin issued for Dewan's vehicle and an Amber Alert issued for Christian. Police officers from multiple departments were involved, and be on the lookout notices were sent to departments in surrounding areas. Medical staff advised police that Christian would, at most, survive 2 to 3 days without his medication. Considering that Dewan reported Christian was already vomiting and showing signs that his illness was taking over, the situation had a very grim outlook. The media became involved quickly, running stories about the theft and abduction on television and radio, and it was actually through the television that Theta became aware that her son was missing. According to Theta, her initial reaction was disbelief. How could this have happened? It didn't take long for her suspicions about the situation to grow. After speaking with Dewan and getting a full report of the information he had to provide, the man was brought down to the police station to speak further with investigators and to await any new information. It didn't take long, as within 2 hours of Dewan reporting Christian as being abducted, the Ferguson Police Department received a call. A man, living on Ronbar Lane, reported an abandoned SUV sitting at the end of a cul-de-sac where the road meets the train tracks. The location of the SUV was approximately 5 miles away from the payphone that Dewan had used to call 911 in the city of Ferguson. Officer Charles Creeley of the Ferguson Police Department arrived on the scene and was able to confirm that the vehicle was in fact DeJuan's, though Christian was nowhere to be found. The vehicle was discovered unlocked with the keys still in the ignition. Police searched the area looking for any signs of where Christian may have been. Dogs were brought in to try and track Christian's scent, though they couldn't pick up on anything. Investigators swept out in a wide radius, utilizing the SUV as the central point, but after knocking on doors, speaking to residents in the area, searching extensively through the woods and even along the train tracks, they were unable to find any trace of Christian. While the search was ongoing, other investigators, examining the SUV itself, were caught off guard by multiple items and details about the vehicle, which they found suspicious. First and foremost, while the vehicle had been reported as stolen, they'd wonder why it had been abandoned just 5 miles from the location from which it was taken. Typically, the motive behind the theft of a vehicle is money-related, and so it seemed incredibly strange to detectives how many valuable items were left inside the vehicle. Among various other electronics, there was a laptop computer, 2 cell phones, binoculars, a bulletproof vest, and a digital camera. Why wouldn't a thief, even if he discovered Christian and decided to abandon the vehicle, at least take some of the smaller items that could be easily fenced for cash? It didn't make any sense. At the same time, DeJuan was operating as a bounty hunter and had a cell phone which he used as part of that job. It was located in the vehicle, along with another phone, and both were in operating condition. If DeJuan had planned to notify the emergency room of his pending arrival with Christian, he didn't need to stop at a payphone. He could have simply used one of his cell phones. Also, his wife Monica was home at the time and could have placed the call for him. In fact, a later check by authorities would show that no phone call made from that payphone had come into the Children's Medical Center that morning. Before the SUV was towed to the Fleet Services Division of the St. Louis Police Department, DeJuan was driven out to the area of 326 Ronbar Lane and shown the location. At this time, he was again questioned about the details of the vehicle's theft and Christian's abduction, and again he confirmed that he had stopped to use the payphone when the vehicle was taken. At this time, he was asked to accompany officers back down to the police department for additional questioning, and he agreed. Once back at the station, DeJuan was questioned more intently about his story, and when officers felt the details simply didn't line up, he was asked to participate in a polygraph examination, which he declined. It was at this time that DeJuan informed officers that he no longer wished to speak with them and would like to have an attorney present. According to an official report, DeJuan was extremely cooperative up until the polygraph request, at which time he ceased his cooperation. DeJuan was represented by attorney John Rogers, and from that time forward has not, quote, assisted in the investigation despite repeated requests through Mr. Rogers, end quote. While DeJuan was at the station, 2 detectives were dispatched to his home to speak with his then-wife Monica, her 2 daughters DeShonda, age 16, and Tia, age 7, as well as Christian's younger brother Connor, who was 8 at the time. Detectives reported that Monica's sister, Lisa, was also present in the home at the time they came over. Monica was questioned about the details of Christian's illness from the night before and the events leading up to him being taken to the hospital. She explained that she had spoken to DeJuan at approximately 11 p.m. the night before, and after that, she'd gone to bed. According to her statement, DeJuan arrived home from his work as a bounty hunter sometime during the night, and that she only learned of the situation with Christian sometime around 6 a.m., when DeJuan called home to inform her that the SUV had been stolen with Christian in it. At this time, Monica explained the details of Christian's illness to the officers and stated that this was not the first time Christian needed to be rushed to the hospital due to an emergency. The following details bother me, and so rather than summarizing for you, I will quote directly from the official police report. Quote, Monica F. recalled one such hospitalization 2 years ago that resulted in a coma. She said that after this incident, Christian F. was severely mentally handicapped, noting that he was not able to speak or communicate in any manner. She described Christian as a vegetable. End quote. When asked if she had been aware of Christian becoming ill the night before, she said that she was not. However, she also said she rarely provided care for Christian because the administration of his medicines was complicated, and that Dewan provided all care for the child, including changing his diapers. Interestingly, when Monica's daughter, Deshonda, was questioned, with Monica's permission, according to the report, quote, "She awoke at about 4 a.m. and heard the SUV start up, leaving the house," end quote. She did not see Dewan nor Christian at that time. When Christian's younger brother, Connor, was questioned, he reported noticing his father entering the room he shared with Christian sometime during the night. The child was not aware of what time it was, though he did note it was very dark outside. According to Connor, Dewan picked up Christian, wrapped him in a blanket, and carried him out to the SUV and drove away. According to the official weather report that day, sunrise was noted as being 5:36 a.m., with early twilight arriving at 5:04 a.m. If indeed Dewan had taken Christian at 4 a.m., as Deshonda noted, or perhaps as late as 5:36 a.m., when the sun was rising, investigators were confounded because the distance from Dewan's home to the payphone was 1.96 miles, and his call to 911 did not come in until 6:09 a.m. At this time, Monica was asked for and consented to a search of the residence. Officers noted that, in Christian and Connor's room, they found his bed was neatly made with a blue bedspread on top. Neither Connor nor Monica knew who had made the bed. The bedroom was noted as having a heavy smell of urine, and that they found items of Christian's clothing, soiled, in a pile on the floor as well as in the closet. Blue pajama bottoms were located at the foot of the bed, and Connor noted that Christian had kicked them off during the night. At this time, Monica agreed to accompany officers down to the station. When asked if the couple knew anyone who lived in the town of Ferguson, Monica reported they had a friend there named Lakeisha Mays. When detectives arrived to speak with Miss Mays, she invited them in and noted that both Dewan had called her about Christian being missing and Monica had called after that, though this call was reported to have been at approximately 6 a.m. Mays was reported as being the owner of a gold 1998 Chevrolet Malibu sedan. Officers noted upon their arrival that the vehicle was not present, and when Mays was questioned about its whereabouts, she explained that she noticed the vehicle missing approximately 1 hour after she'd spoken with Dewan, and that she did not consider the vehicle stolen, as her mother and her girlfriend, Monica and Dewan, all had keys to the car and would borrow it, though usually they'd leave a message beforehand, and on this occasion, no one had. When authorities later spoke to May's mother and her girlfriend, both denied borrowing or using May's vehicle that morning. May's vehicle was located later, at 4:38 p.m., parked along a curb at 1288 Hodiamont Avenue, near its intersection with Page Boulevard. The vehicle was found less than 100 yards from the very payphone Dewan had used to report the abduction. This vehicle was also towed to the Fleet Service Division for examination. Mays voluntarily accompanied police down to the station for additional questioning, at which time she described her relationship with Monica and Dewan as friends. She said she stayed over their home once in a while and that their children played together. According to her statement, the last time she had visited the home was Sunday, June 8th. Several plastic bags of clothing were found in the vehicle, though Mays later identified these items as belonging to her. According to her statement, she had left the clothes behind at the Ferguson's house, and Dewan had told her, on June 10th, the day before Christian's disappearance, that he would be returning the clothes to her. Officers managed to track down Ozell Scott, a bounty hunter who had been with Dewan the night before. According to Scott, when he placed his gear in the back of the maroon SUV belonging to Dewan the night before, he saw several plastic bags of clothing. When he asked Dewan what that was about, he claims Dewan stated the clothes belonged to Mays. In addition to this, Scott explained that Dewan had borrowed his cell phone multiple times during the night, and he believed he'd made calls to both Monica and Mays, and that they were arguing. According to the report, quote, "He did not know the exact nature of the arguments, but he believes one of the calls with Monica F. was in regard to the medication that Christian F. needed to take. End quote. Scott noted he last saw Dewan at approximately 1:30 a.m. on June 11th. While investigators were going through the items in Dewan's SUV, they reportedly discovered a letter, handwritten by Monica, which detailed an open, ongoing sexual relationship which Dewan was allegedly having with both Monica and Mays. It was also noted that the bags of clothing Scott had reported from the night before were not in the SUV and are believed to be the ones that were found in Mays' vehicle. When Mays was initially questioned, she claimed to have been friends with the couple, though in a follow-up, she admitted that she and Monica both shared a sexual relationship with Dewan and one another, which included some three-way encounters. She did not tell investigators earlier, she said, because it was personal and she didn't believe it was pertinent to the case. Mays also explained that while she now had her own residence, from May through June 8th, she had in fact been living with Monica and Dewan. The three-way relationship had begun in February, and Mays' reason for moving out was partially due to disputes between she and Monica, though she said these disputes were never about Dewan or the children. In a subsequent interview, May stated that Dewan had called her on the 11th, after police were involved, and when she explained to him that her car had been found near the phone, he acknowledged this as a good thing. When asked how her car had gotten there, Mays claims Dewan responded by saying that he didn't want to discuss it over the phone. Mays later claimed that Dewan had in fact used her vehicle that night and that he'd told her so in a later conversation. In addition to this statement, multiple witnesses reported seeing her vehicle near the spot it was later found at as early as 6 a.m. on June 11th. One witness stated he saw an African-American male walking west on Page Boulevard, coming from the direction of where the car was later found. The witness saw this male then use the payphone which Dewan had used to call police and later pick Dewan's photo out of a photograph lineup. A videotape made by a Fox News reporter that same morning showed a vehicle matching Mays parked in the same location it was later found at approximately 7:45 a.m. It seemed apparent early on that investigators were very suspicious of Dewan's statements and his account of what had happened on the morning of June 11th. The details regarding May's vehicle, which he had access to, multiple calls allegedly made between Dewan, Monica, and Mays, which both Monica and Dewan denied, and the fact that the only item missing from the stolen SUV was Dewan's handicapped son. While investigators were busy compiling evidence, Theda was highly outspoken about her presumptions that Dewan may have been lying about what had happened. In one interview, she stated, quote, "Sometimes I have to catch myself when I speak about it. I say he came up missing, but he didn't come up missing, and that is what angers me the most." End quote. Over the course of the next few months, investigators continued working the case, though they received no leads or tips. 8 weeks after Christian had been reported missing, the St. Louis Police Department went on record with their belief that Christian was deceased, though they still kept it as a missing persons case. Reportedly, the prosecutor's office met multiple times with the St. Louis police to discuss the case, though their public statements have specified that they did not have enough evidence to prosecute. When authorities discovered that Dewan and Monica had since moved out of their home, doing so within a month and a half of Christian's disappearance, they tracked down the owner, and it was listed as belonging to a Mary King located in Evansville, Indiana. According to King, Dewan contacted her and told her not to allow police to search the residence, but, wanting to cooperate, King willingly signed a consent to search form. The home was searched on August 12th and 13th by the St. Louis Police Department with the assistance of the FBI Evidence Response Team. In their haste to move, Dewan and Monica had left many items behind in the now vacant home. Photographs were taken of items of Christian's clothing, found soaked in urine. By the use of light-sensitive tools, they found a tremendous stain on the bedding of Christian's bed, soaking through to the mattress, leaking onto the bed frame, and puddling on the floor. An item, referred to as a G-tube or gastrostomy tube, was found in the porch area of the home. This is commonly called a feeding tube, and Christian did have one implanted in his body. It was noted that the tube showed signs of blood and other bodily fluids and was unsanitary. On the end of the tube, which is extended out from the body, marks were discovered which were believed to have been caused by tools. On the other end, which is the end that is surgically implanted in the body, is a plastic bladder. The bladder, however, was collapsed, and it appeared the device had been forcibly removed from the body. Medications prescribed for Christian were also found in the home, in addition to medication which had previously been seized by investigators, showing that his prescriptions hadn't been filled since April, and there was far too much medicine left for him to have been properly medicated. Following this search, and based in part upon information given to authorities from Mays, a massive search was conducted on August 19th and 20th in the city of Kinloch, Missouri. This search included more than 100 police officers from various departments and cadaver dogs. The search was extremely extensive, though at its conclusion, nothing was found. Margaret Binion, a registered nurse who, for a time, had been assigned to provide home care for Christian, had a disturbing story to tell. According to Binion, she noted that Christian visibly flinched when she approached, making her wonder if he had been physically abused. The child was confined to specific rooms of the house, as he had an oral fixation which caused him to chew on items. On several occasions, Binion reported arriving at the home to treat Christian, finding the child home alone and the front door left unlocked. Other times, the family would keep her waiting on the porch for a while, and she believed they were scrambling to clean up Christian to make it appear as though they were properly caring for him, though on other occasions, she reported she would find Christian wearing urine-soaked clothing and the same diaper she had placed on him the previous day. Binion also explained that on one occasion, she had witnessed Christian displaying symptoms that he was worsening, and when she called Monica, she was told, quote, "Leave him, wait an hour, we're used to this," end quote. When Dewan and Monica arrived home an hour later, they then took Christian to the hospital. Multiple other nurses reported similar problems related to neglect. Christian wasn't being fed properly, taken care of properly, given his medication properly, nor did these nurses feel that the family generally cared. It has been said that Connor, Christian's younger brother, loved Christian and did his best to try and help him, but he was only 8 years old. When nurses would report that the medications needed to be filled, Dewan would take his time about it, not getting them in time and often causing the child to go without. One nurse reported that she quit when Dewan had called her, screaming at her that she didn't order new diapers. She informed him that that was his responsibility, and he allegedly screamed some more. She reported being frightened of him. All in all, more than five nurses from 2001 to 2002 reported multiple instances of neglect and abuse. The list of their accusations goes on, and I could continue, but frankly, it's fucking sickening to me, so I'll link the official report on the website and in the show notes for those of you who have the stomach to read these horrifying and hideous accounts. In terms of Christian's medication, pharmacy records indicate that multiple medications necessary for Christian's health were not being filled in a timely manner. For example, sodium benzonate, a medication which is used to remove nitrogen and waste to help decrease the load on the urea cycle, was filled for a 30-day period on September 19, 2002. It was not filled again until 74 days later on December 2nd. The next time it was refilled after that was February 7th, 67 days later. This happened with four of Christian's necessary medications, with the most atrocious example of the failure to properly medicate the child being in the case of polycitric K solution, filled on December 2nd, 2002 for a 30-day supply and not refilled until 141 days later on April 22nd, 2003. Dr. Grange followed Christian's health, operating as a clinical geneticist from the time he was born. According to her, whenever the nurses were taking care of Christian, he wouldn't be rushed to the hospital. But when they weren't, it would happen more often, leading her to believe that it was less to do with an underlying medical condition and more to do with a lack of care. The last time Dr. Grange reported seeing Christian was in March of 2003, when registered nurse Kimberly Nero made an appointment to discuss dietary concerns. According to Grange, she hadn't seen Christian in a year, and normally a patient with Christian's illness would be seen every 3 months. The medical facility sent multiple letters to Dewan pointing out missed appointments, though they were never responded to. Dr. Grange also noted that, on this last visit, Christian was brought in by Nurse Nero, and neither Dewan nor Monica were present, and she felt the father was becoming more ambivalent to the condition of his son. Even though I've already given you a warning about the content in this episode, I do want to specify that the next thing I'm going to tell you is tremendously heartbreaking. In subsequent investigations, Christian's younger brother Connor was spoken to once again, about the morning of June 11th, when he witnessed Dewan taking Christian out of the house. His story remained consistent. I'm going to directly quote from the report. Quote, Connor stated that Christian had gotten very thin, and that he could see his bones through his skin. Connor would sneak food into the bedroom for Christian, usually a Pop-Tart or Cheetos. He said that Christian was always hungry and would eat anything if it was given to him. Connor said he felt sorry for his brother since Christian would only get his formula once a day. Connor came home from his last day of school on Monday, June 9th, 2003, and noticed Christian's G button was missing. Connor said he saw dried blood around where the G button would go in Christian. He looked for the G button and could not find it. End quote. The G button was how Connor referred to his brother's feeding tube. The day before Christian went missing, Connor said that he had been very sick and had been moaning throughout the afternoon. He says he told Monica, who allegedly responded that she knew all about it and to just stay out of Christian's room, and then she went back to ironing. Connor then explained that he went to check on Christian and he was lying flat on his back, not making a sound, and all that he could see were the whites of Christian's eyes as they appeared to have rolled back into his head. The belief was that the feeding tube had been removed from Christian. He then slowly died over the course of 48 hours, leading up to June 11th, at which time he was reported missing. Unfortunately, there was not enough evidence to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt in the eyes of investigators or the prosecution. Based on many statements and what can be proven, it was hypothesized that Dewan came home at approximately 4 a.m. and removed Christian from the home, the child already being deceased. It is suggested that Dewan disposed of Christian's body in an undisclosed location, drove his SUV to the cul-de-sac where it was later found, leaving it there at approximately 5 a.m. He then walked less than a mile to the residence of Lakeisha Mays and used spare keys to take the vehicle. He later parked this car 100 yards from the payphone on a side street, walked to the phone, and dialed 911 to report his son missing. In response to much of this, at the suggestion of a guardian ad litem, Christian's younger brother Connor was placed in the temporary custody of his grandparents. A permanent custody hearing was to take place, once again overseen by Judge Frawley, who denied Theta's request to have a new guardian appointed, as this one had previously sided with Dewan. After denying this, the judge had the court file sealed. Despite Dewan not appearing at court, and the judge demanding to know what had happened with Christian, he ultimately awarded full custody to Dewan's mother and stepfather. In part of his reasoning, the judge alleged that DHS had not been able to prove any of Theta's claims of abuse and neglect. For the next few years, Connor lived with his grandparents and was well taken care of. By 2007, though, it was reported that Connor was acting out, and his relationship with his grandparents' two children was failing. At this time, his grandparents agreed to relinquish custody to Theta under an agreement that, in part, specified that Connor was not to speak to the media about his brother's disappearance. Over the years, Theta has been assisted in conducting additional searches. The Sean Hornbeck Foundation helped set up a search and rescue team. Hundreds volunteered and brought trained tracking dogs. The dogs were given Christian scent off his clothing, and they extensively searched the cities of Ferguson, Kinloch, Wellston, and Berkeley. Eventually, though, the transition was made from tracking dogs to cadaver dogs. Nothing was ever found. Victor Thomas, whom Theta married in 1999, later stated, quote, "For 2.5 years, my life consisted of living in the woods. When there was nobody else with me, I'd go out myself. The nights I couldn't sleep, I'd sit out on the porch and think of places to search." End quote. Thomas would get a shock in 2004 when he opened his front door and found an unmarked envelope. Inside the envelope was the St. Louis Police Department's confidential report on the case. He never knew who left it there, but it seemed apparent that someone in law enforcement wanted the truth to get to Christian's mother. In 2007, Theda wrote a letter to the chief of the St. Louis Police Department. In it, she asked a series of questions, including, "If you know that Dewan T. Ferguson, a former bounty hunter and Christian's biological father, made a false police report on June 11, 2003, why hasn't he been charged for making that false report? What has your department done since January 6, 2005 to locate Christian?" Over the years, Theda had reached out to television shows, true crime personalities, and the Department of Human Services, asking questions and wanting coverage of Christian's case. Following her 2007 letter, the St. Louis police, in conjunction with the FBI, formed a five-person task force to review the case over the course of 30 days. This task force re-interviewed witnesses, had cadaver dogs search the location where a home was built by Dewan's father-in-law's construction company, and even requested permission to dig in a landfill, though that was denied. Ultimately, they found nothing new. Multiple police department officials have made off-the-record comments, essentially equating to the fact that, while they believe the father is guilty, they do not want to risk double jeopardy by taking this to trial without enough evidence. Theda would later argue that it may in fact be Dewan's stepfather, who is a powerful man in St. Louis with a lot of money and political connections, who has actually been keeping his stepson away from being charged. The years have been hard for Theda, and Connor, and everyone that cared for Christian and has been faced with this injustice. Theda, though, has managed to take her grief and her anger and to transform it into something positive. She founded Looking for an Angel, a nonprofit organization housed in Ferguson, Missouri, that assists the families of missing relatives. Their website can be found at lookingforanangel.org. Theda has worked hard to keep Christian's story in the spotlight, organizing a memorial parade, walks, and events to help draw attention and funds for rewards, as well as aiding other families who participate in these events. When asked about this, Theda responded, quote, "I have to do everything I can do to bring out the truth, so today is about promoting awareness of Christian circumstances and trying to do whatever we can to keep kids safe. And I'm going to do it until I get what I want, and that's justice for my son." End quote. Lieutenant Kimberly Allen of the St. Louis Police Department, when asked about the case, responded, quote, "We are very limited on what we can tell the family, and I know that's part of the frustration. No information is too small. Our hearts go out to the family. I'm not a mother, but I could only imagine." End quote. June 11th, 2019 will mark 16 years since Christian was last seen. If alive today, he would have been 26. In more than 16 years, it seems a lot of information was gathered, though perhaps not enough in the eyes of the law to fully move forward with charges. In the absence of justice and charges, two theories have been put forth by investigators, family, and those who have simply examined this case. The first theory argues that Dewan's original story is true and that Christian was in fact present in the SUV that morning. According to supporters of Dewan, it's highly probable that someone stole the vehicle when they saw it running in the parking lot. It's believed that when Christian was discovered in the back seat, the thief panicked, disposed of the child, and ran off, not wanting to be charged with murder. The second theory, and by far the most popular, suggests that Christian's disappearance was a complete and utter fabrication created by his father and the man who many believe was either directly or indirectly responsible for his death. The question for many, however, is whether or not this was a crime perpetrated by one man alone or if he had assistance. Some believe that Christian was outright murdered, while others believe that his death was the result of extensive negligence. Either way, for those who support this theory, they believe Dewan holds the answers. When last seen, Christian Ferguson was described as being an African-American boy with black hair and brown eyes, standing 4 feet tall and weighing approximately 75 pounds. At the time of his disappearance, Christian had a short Afro-style haircut and was reported by his father to have last been wearing only a diaper and being wrapped in a blue and red blanket. Christian is sometimes referred to by the nickname Chris and is described as extremely thin, with a frail build, and that he drools frequently. Depending on who you believe, Christian was either last seen in the vicinity of Page Boulevard and Skinker Avenue, in the backseat of a maroon SUV which was stolen and discovered 5 miles away at a cul-de-sac on Ron Bar Lane, or Christian was last seen in his bed sometime between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m., being wrapped in a blanket and carried out of the home by his father, DeJuan Ferguson. Christian suffers from a lethal disorder known as citral anemia, and without proper medication and care, cannot survive, and it is commonly believed Christian is likely deceased, though his case is still considered an endangered missing child case. Christian Ferguson was a 9-year-old boy who went missing. After coming into the world and nearly dying within his first 72 hours of life, he beat the odds, persevered despite the necessity of extensive medications, dietary restrictions, and treatments. He grew, went to school, was having as close to a normal life as possible, and then all of a sudden, he fell deathly ill and sustained brain damage, which forever altered the course of his life. Christian was severely handicapped following the incident, and for the next 2 years he was, according to multiple reports from nurses and doctors, subjected to a horrifying lack of care, at a minimum, and direct abuse and negligence at a maximum. Then, all of a sudden, one day he's gone, and the details of the story are about as concise and logical as the suspect would tell on a half-assed crime drama. And yet, 16 years later, tons of witness statements, sightings, timelines, contradictions, and outright discovered lies, nothing has happened. Theta continues to hope for justice, saying, quote, "I want answers. I don't want to die and people say, Mom died before she got closure." This was, by far, one of the most challenging episodes I've ever researched or written. Digging into the police reports, reading the terrible accounts of the conditions that Christian lived in and how he was treated, are absolutely horrifying. I can't even for a single second begin to fathom the concept of having a disabled child and treating them this way. It's not like they didn't know, it's not like this came as a surprise. DeJuan fought in court multiple times to keep custody of both of his sons, and yet it seems apparent that he may have only cared about being the father to one of them. I can't begin to imagine what it's like to be the parent of a child who has a severe handicap and needs constant care. I imagine it's difficult, challenging, physically and emotionally exhausting, but you do it because you love your child. You want to make things as good as possible for them. This is clearly not what happened in this situation. I could honestly go on and on about the conditions, but it's been hard enough to try and maintain any level of professionalism while covering this story, so I digress. Christian Ferguson was 9 years old when his father alleges that he was in the backseat of an SUV when it was stolen by an unknown person. According to all of the evidence which could be compiled, there seems to be a great deal of information suggesting this story may not be true, versus pretty much no evidence to support that it was true. No suspects were ever found, no arrests ever made. In the subsequent investigation and the 16 years that have passed since then, Theta has worked tirelessly to keep her son's name and case in the public, while DeJuan has remained silent, uninvolved in any of the searches, televised interviews, and even chooses not to respond to articles written about the case, let alone the questions police would love to ask. So what do we really have? A 9-year-old boy with a severe handicap that leaves him unable to speak or swallow, requires feeding through a surgically implanted feeding tube, who struggles to walk on his own and who needs constant monitoring and supervision to ensure that he is healthy, up and vanishes from a stolen vehicle, from which I might add, absolutely nothing else was taken. When you look at this case, there is little here which makes sense, and the story of Christian's abduction is about as ludicrous as one could imagine, but for argument's sake, and in hopes of maintaining a professional stance on it, I chose to cover two theories rather than just the major one. So let's begin with the first theory, that DeJuan's account of that morning is true, and Christian was actually abducted. According to Dewan, sometime between 5:30 and 6 a.m., he found Christian in his bed unconscious and with clear evidence that he had been vomiting. Loss of consciousness and vomiting are both indicators that the citrullinemia was flaring up and he needed to be rushed to the hospital in order to be given proper treatment to save his life. Dewan has said he grabbed a red and blue blanket, wrapped up the child, who at the time was wearing only a diaper, carried him out to his SUV, placed him in the back, and then began to drive to the Children's Medical Center. Dewan went on to explain that, in his haste, he hadn't called ahead to the hospital to notify them of his pending arrival with Christian, and so, in order to let them know, less than 2 miles from his home, he stopped the vehicle, left it running with the keys in the ignition, walked approximately 100 yards to a payphone at a small strip of stores, and called the hospital. It was during this call that he witnessed his SUV driving off heading east, and he immediately realized that someone had stolen the vehicle with his sick son in the back seat. He then called 911, and the search for the SUV and Christian began. The idea of a vehicle being stolen from St. Louis is certainly a possible one. St. Louis is a city with a very high crime rate. In fact, on a ranking from 1 to 100, in which 100 is considered safe, St. Louis ranks at 1, meaning that the city is safer than 1% of all U.S. cities. In the entire state of Missouri, you have a 1 in 35 chance of being the victim of a crime related to the theft of property, but in St. Louis, that chance is 1 in 16. In the entire state, there are 28.3 property crimes committed for every 1,000 residents, but in St. Louis, that is 60.9 per 1,000 residents. It seems quite clear that car theft isn't exactly a rarity in the city of St. Louis. In the calendar year of 2017, St. Louis reported 8,100 stolen vehicles. Of course, it becomes a question of why people steal vehicles, and it's typically for monetary gain. A car thief might take your vehicle to a chop shop and part it out, or perhaps drive it to a port where it can be loaded up and shipped to another country. Some just take the car for a joyride, beat the hell out of it, and leave it abandoned somewhere, while others attempt to resell the car to an unsuspecting buyer in hopes of making a quick buck. It's safe to say that when your vehicle is stolen, it's rare to get it back, but even more so rare is to get it back with all of your valuable items still inside. But that's what happens here. The SUV is recovered just 2 hours after it's reported missing, some 5 miles away from the location it was stolen from. The vehicle has sustained no damage, isn't parked erratically or smashed into anything. It's parked as if someone drove it down the road, turned the engine off, left the keys in the ignition, and just walked away. Multiple valuable electronics and other items are left behind, seemingly untouched in the vehicle. In fact, the only thing missing is Christian Ferguson. Apparently, a laptop, digital camera, 2 cell phones, and other items were not appealing, but a sick and possibly dying child wrapped in a blanket in the back seat was. How many car thieves decide, you know what? I don't want this car, but I'll take this sick child. It's also strange in general to imagine that there just happened to be a car thief hanging out in the area at 6 in the morning on a Wednesday, just waiting for someone to leave him a vehicle to steal, and it must have just been his lucky day, since not only did he find one to steal, he didn't even have to work for it. It was left running with the keys in the ignition, and while the owner was on the phone some 300 feet away, the thief was able to enter the vehicle, shift into gear, and drive away before the owner even noticed, only being spotted as he drove out of sight. That's a hell of a lucky car thief. So, the thief drives away. According to Dewan, it would be hard for the thief to notice Christian in the back seat as he's sleeping, or possibly unconscious, and wrapped up in a blanket. I guess the blanket was covering his face? That has never been made clear. Either way, this guy is driving along, and suddenly he notices there's a child in the back seat. He freaks out, realizing that, beyond mere Grand Theft Auto, he may also be held accountable for kidnapping. So he pulls over at the end of a cul-de-sac in a neighborhood just 5 miles from where he stole the car, turns it off, leaves the keys in the ignition, grabs the child that he doesn't want to be in trouble for abducting, and abducts him. A child who, according to what we know, is either unconscious, vomiting, or both. And from there, the car thief just vanishes. No one sees him in the area. No one reports a man carrying a child in a blue and red blanket. No one sees anything. And to this day, not a single scrap of evidence is found to actually put a car thief in that SUV. It was processed. There were no prints or fibers. no hairs or other fragments of evidence to suggest that anyone had been in the vehicle that day. The seat is in the same position, no mirrors are adjusted, and this thief, who must have just stolen the SUV for a reason, leaves behind thousands of dollars worth of electronics and other items in order to instead steal a sick, possibly dying, severely handicapped child. Then what? Does he bring Christian home and try to raise him as his own? Does he merely dispose of the child somewhere and somehow, despite extensive searches, not even a shred of the blanket is found? Tracking dogs have his scent and can't even pick it up in the area, and yet he must have been there when the SUV was parked, right? The only information we have which suggests that the SUV was stolen is the account of Dewan Ferguson, which has more holes in it than a fishnet. So sure, someone could have stolen the SUV, realized Christian was there, and run off with the child and the child alone. Anything is possible. But when you apply even the slightest amount of logic, this seems like an incredibly ridiculous theory. All evidence discovered in this case points in the opposite direction, and that takes us to the second and final theory, that Dewan knows a lot more about his son's whereabouts than he has been forthcoming about. When you look at the timeline, you'll find some interesting details. Dewan was last seen at 1:30 a.m. by his friend and fellow bounty hunter Ozell Scott. According to Scott, Dewan uses his phone to speak to both Monica and Mays that night, and there's clearly arguing going on. Scott believes that the argument between Dewan and Monica is about Christian's medicine. Less than 3 hours later, at approximately 4 a.m., Dewan's stepdaughter, 16 at the time, reports hearing the SUV door closing and the sound of it driving away from the home. Connor, who shares a bedroom with Christian, reports seeing his father entering the room, wrapping Christian in a blanket, carrying him out, and driving off. The 8-year-old doesn't know what time it was, but he knows it's still dark out, and the first light of the day began showing in the sky between 5:04 and 5:36 a.m. So, it seems safe to assume Connor witnessed this taking place sometime before 5:36, and if the account of 16-year-old DeShonda is accurate, this could have happened any time between 4 a.m. and 5:36. The payphone from which Dewan called police is located 1.96 miles from his home. The 911 call came in at 6:09. It certainly wouldn't have taken more than, what, 5-10 minutes to make that drive? Let's be lenient and say 10. That means Dewan should have left his home no earlier than 5:59 a.m. The sun was already up, so this couldn't have been when Connor saw him take Christian. It's certainly much later than DeShonda's account of 4 a.m., so where were Dewan and Christian during this missing gap of time? He couldn't have been rushing him anywhere if it took him over an hour to get to that payphone. The phone call itself doesn't even make sense. There are two cell phones in the vehicle. Dewan is aware of this. Instead of using one of them to call the hospital, he stops at a payphone. Even in 2003, when this happened, payphones were already on their way out of common public use due to the rise of cell phones. I guess another question would be why he was calling in the first place. Typically, when you're rushing someone to the hospital, you don't call ahead. I would love to know if this was a common practice when Dewan rushed Christian to the hospital in the past. The hospital is, in fact, so well-versed in Christian that there's actually a standing order that if he is rushed in, he needs to be treated immediately. That makes it seem like a call is even less necessary. And then there is the fact that no call to the hospital was made from that payphone that day. So if this isn't what happened, then what did happen? A lot of credit goes to the investigators here who managed to compile a really tight timeline of events and who were able to put a lot of the pieces of this puzzle together. We know that the area the SUV was found in was less than a mile away from the residence of Lakeisha Mays, a woman with whom Dewan and Monica shared a sexual relationship. Both Dewan and Monica have access to Mays' vehicle, and on that morning the vehicle is not present at her house when investigators arrive. She doesn't know who has it, though she does later tell authorities that it was in fact Dewan. Even if she hadn't been aware of this, the evidence seems to point that way. The previous night, Ozell Scott saw bags of clothes in Dewan's SUV, which are found in May's car the following afternoon. Somehow, they got from one vehicle to the other. Where is May's car found? Oh, approximately 100 yards from the payphone at which Dewan called 911. Huh. There are witnesses from that day who see the car parked on the side street, one of whom sees a man walking from the car to the payphone, and this witness later identifies that man as Dewan Ferguson. If only that account is true, it proves that DeJuan, at a minimum, lied to investigators about the circumstances that brought him to the payphone that morning. How difficult is it, really, to imagine that something happened with Christian and he was disposed of, somewhere which is yet to be identified? The SUV was then driven and parked in the cul-de-sac, at which time the driver could easily have walked to May's home, taken the car with their key, and driven it over to the side road, to then walk to the payphone and file a false police report. This isn't very complicated, and overall involves parking the SUV, borrowing a car, driving 5 miles, and making a phone call, all of which could have easily been done inside of the time window we have, which seems to stretch from anywhere between 4 a.m. to 6:09 a.m. In fact, the entire drive from DeJuan's home to where the SUV was found is 7 miles. It certainly seems possible that this is something that could have been pulled off. Then when you look deeper, you've got contradictory stories. May says she heard from DeJuan that Christian was missing and then later heard from Monica, but she recalls Monica contacting her around 6 a.m. Well, DeJuan didn't report Christian as missing until 6:09, and it seems unlikely that May's would have been his next call instead of Monica, but then again, this entire relationship is far more complicated than I have the time or the energy to try and figure out. Monica, though, claims that she spoke to DeJuan at 11 p.m., and then she didn't hear from him again until he told her that Christian was missing. So, he was apparently calling 911 to report his son missing, then he called Monica or Mays, then he was speaking to the police within minutes of his 911 call, so I suppose those calls to Monica or Mays or both were quite short. DeJuan tells the story to police, who at first believe it, and within 2 hours already think it's a lie. They bring DeJuan to the station to talk, they bring him to the SUV and ask more questions, they bring him back to the station for further questioning, and when they ask him to take a polygraph, he says no and requests a lawyer. That's not suspicious to me. Polygraphs are notoriously inaccurate, and I never blame anyone for not wanting to take them. What is suspicious is that this is the last communication DeJuan has with anyone connected to the investigation or any subsequent searches for his son. He doesn't participate in searches. He doesn't give interviews, he doesn't work to get the story out in the media, he doesn't put up flyers, he doesn't march in parades of awareness, he doesn't do anything. From this moment on, he is behind the wall of his lawyer, and 16 years later, he's never said a thing about it. Then, police find what can only be described as an incredible amount of accounts from nurses and medical staff reporting that Christian was not being given the medicine he needed in the amounts he needed, nor at the intervals it was to be given. May says that when she lived with DeJuan and Monica, that Christian was kept off in other rooms, that only DeJuan gave him medicine, and if DeJuan wasn't there, well, then Christian went without his medicine. Connor, 8 years old at the time, tells a harrowing tale of how he, wanting to help his sick brother, tried to feed him because his family was only giving him formula once a day. He reports Christian being so skinny he can see his bones poking through his skin. When police later search the home, they find soiled clothing and what appears to be Christian's feeding tube, and evidence that it was forcibly removed from the body. Just imagine an adult using a tool to rip a feeding tube out of a 9-year-old. Connor describes that Christian's tube was missing, and there was dried blood on his stomach where the tube used to be, 2 days before he went missing. Now, I suppose the argument could be made that the tube wasn't forcibly removed, I guess it fell out by some miraculous accident, but the immediate response for someone who wishes to save Christian's life when his feeding tube is out is to rush him to the hospital. Well, DeJuan doesn't try and take him to the hospital until the morning of the 11th, and that's 2 days after the feeding tube was allegedly removed. That's 36 to 48 hours, during which time Christian could not be fed through his necessary feeding tube. We know from inventory taken later that there was far too much medicine left behind to have suggested that it was being given to the child the way it was supposed to be, and there were tremendous gaps in time between when the prescriptions were filled, when they needed to be filled, and then when they were actually filled. This, on top of what can only be described as unsanitary living conditions and ambivalence from DeJuan and Monica, seems to suggest that Christian's health and well-being was not a top priority for them. Occam's razor suggests the simplest answer is the most likely. Which makes more sense here? A random person stole a vehicle, found a sick child in it, took the child, left behind a bunch of valuable items, and the vehicle, only to disappear into the ether, or that a father who was seemingly neglecting his handicapped child did something to eliminate the burden on his life and then concocted a story that falls completely apart once you begin investigating it. There is a very clear line between those two possibilities, and on one side of that line is logic and evidence, and on the other side is a story told by one person who just happens to be the last person to claim to have been in the presence of his missing son, who has not been seen again for 16 years. This is a terrible story, and it's heartbreaking, and it's frustrating. There seems to be so much pointing in one direction, and yet no legal action has yet been taken. I don't know what the hell it's going to take at this point. Perhaps the recovery of Christian's remains, which at a minimum would give his mother the ability to put him to rest. Theda long ago accepted the reality that Christian is probably gone, and she also believes in her heart that Dewan knows exactly what happened. Remember, Dewan had stopped allowing Theda to see her sons, violating a court order. That court demanded he allow Theda to see the kids, and it just so happened that Christian went missing 3 days before that was going to happen. Is it possible that someone didn't want Theda to see what was really going on? The disappearance of Christian Ferguson remains classified as a missing and endangered persons case. Of course, if alive today, Christian would have been 26 years old. He's been gone for twice as long as he was alive, and while his father completely avoids the topic and takes no part in anything related to bringing attention to this story, Theda is still out there pushing for justice. She runs a nonprofit to help others who are in her situation and who have suffered the loss of a child or a loved one. She has tried to take her grief and pain and to turn it into something positive, but she's never let go of the hope that someday she'll know the truth and that someone will face justice. Until then, she remembers Christian as she last knew him, a sweet, loving little boy who would coo softly and excitedly when his mother scooped him up into her arms. While some cases have no information or evidence, this is not one of those cases. There is information here. There are places to look. There are questions that demand answers. And we can only hope that at some point, someone comes forward with proof, gives investigators a new tip, or evidence of the case is finally considered enough to pursue charges. Until then, the disappearance of Christian Ferguson remains open, unsolved, and cold.
Case update.
16 years after Christian's disappearance, in October of 2019, St. Louis County arrested and charged his father, Dewan, with one count of first-degree murder. He is currently being held without bond. While the details of what resulted in Dewan being charged haven't yet been revealed, I would argue there's a good chance it has to do with the fact that his wife, who he was married to during the time Christian disappeared, filed for divorce 1 month prior to Dewan being charged. When asked about the arrest, Theda told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, quote, "I knew that justice was on its way, but I'm in shock. I feel supported and I'm excited. I'm a lot of different things right now because I don't know how to be in this place, but I'm glad I'm here," end quote. Theda has long fought for justice for her son and has been very involved in victim advocacy. As of now, Dewan Ferguson is in prison and awaiting trial. His defense attorney has argued that he'll get the case thrown out, but only time will tell what new developments in this extremely sad and disturbing case will be revealed.
If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Christian Ferguson, there are several articles and forums discussing his case. Theda has done several televised interviews which can be found on YouTube. Her nonprofit, lookingforanangel.org, also has some information about Christian and other cases. If you have any information about the disappearance of Christian Ferguson, please contact the St. Louis Police Department at area code 314-444-5620 or lookingforanangel.org at area code 314-440-3420. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. This year, CrimeCon will be held in New Orleans from June 7th through the 9th. Amidst exciting presentations and inspiring discussions, I'm really looking forward to attending and representing Trace Evidence on Podcast Row. If you're planning to attend but haven't yet purchased your pass, you can save 10% by using the promo code TRACE19. Simply visit crimecon.com, select a standard pass, and use the code TRACE19. That's TRACE19 to save 10% today. I look forward to seeing you there. A special shout out goes to Patreon producers Alicia Lorraine, Krista Colvin, Deani Dyson, Eamon Brady, Kate Alexander, Chandra Moreau, Tara Doble, and Tom Archer. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence. Visit trace-evidence.com for all episodes, social media links, merchandise, and more. I want to thank you all for listening to this episode, and remind you that if you're planning to attend CrimeCon in New Orleans, to use the promo code TRACE19 for 10% off a standard badge. I'll be on Podcast Row and can't wait to meet all of you. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.